Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. Later on in the hour, we'll talk to UCSF doctors and scientists about the impact of uncertain federal funding on our public health and on the cutting-edge research happening here in the Bay. And at the end of the hour, we're going to hear from the director of the new film Underdogs about how the human-dog bond transforms incarcerated people. But first, last month, San Francisco's Rose Pack Democratic Club ended its long affiliation with the Democratic Party. This shift represents something. We are going to try to figure out what that is. Has the Democratic Party taken Asian American voters for granted? Are Asian American voters shifting right? Tonight, I am pleased to be joined by Jeremy Lee, president of the Rose Pack Democratic Club. Welcome to State of the Bay, Jeremy.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And we're also joined by Ko Len Cheung, Asian American and Pacific Islander reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome to State of the Bay, Ko Len.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have both of you on the line here. And Jeremy, to get us started, can you explain who Rose Pack was and why she is important to the Asian American and perhaps specifically the Chinese American community in the city?
Oh, yeah, of course. Rose Pack was an incredible community advocate. She is responsible for bringing things like the Central Subway to Chinatown after the tearing down of the Embarcadero Freeway. She was just a tremendous advocate in uplifting specifically the Chinese American community and making sure that government really worked for the people and was responsive to their needs.
And Jeremy, when did the Rose Pack Democratic Club get started?
It was in 2016, shortly after the passing of our dear Auntie Rose.
And then can you talk about why the club ended its affiliation with the Democratic Party? What led to that decision?
Yeah, of course. So we actually had been thinking about leaving the party for some time. It was a decision largely driven by our interactions with the monolingual residents throughout San Francisco, as well as the national political environment. Through our outreach work with monolingual voters, we heard that these voters had distrust in the Democratic Party. They didn't really see how the party benefited their daily lives and were often distrustful when we introduced ourselves as a part of a Democratic club. So, shortly after the election, we made the decision to leave, mainly as a way to better connect with voters, just through kind of some of the cross-cutting. We noticed like there were voters who voted for Trump and voted for some quite progressive Asian supervisor candidates. So ideology isn't as ingrained in these voters as we think they are. And so we wanted to take advantage of this kind of environment and try to reach some of these voters.
And Jeremy, were there any specific issues that seemed to cause a rift between these voters that you were talking to and their perception, or maybe the accurate perception of what the Democratic Party stood for?
I think, here in deep blue San Francisco, the Chinese American community knows that Democrats are in power, but, in their daily lives, it's hard to really see what benefits the Democratic Party brings. Cost of living is increasing. It's harder to keep up with the wages, send your kids to school, have a decent life. And really, our immigrant communities just want to achieve their American dream, just work hard and make it in this country.
And Ko Len Cheung, let me bring you into this conversation, Asian American and Pacific Islander reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. What is your take on this change for the Rose Pack Democratic Club? How significant do you think this is?
I think, as Jeremy pointed out, the club is not changing its values, right? They're still a very much more progressive-leaning club. It's that they think they can better serve their community by not affiliating politically with the Democratic Party because of the sense of alienation that some immigrant voters feel toward the Democratic Party. And I think it's certainly how those voters feel of not feeling like the Democrats represent them is part of a very modest but still noticeable change in the Asian American voter base in California and San Francisco, where there was from 2018 to 2022 a 2-point increase in Republican Party registration. That being said, we still have to acknowledge that we're still in a very deeply Democratic area. Democratic Party registration among Asian Americans increased by even more than that among Republican Asian Americans. So let's not like overstate the impact here, but it is noticeable.
So it's not like we're going to be seeing MAGA trucks driving through San Francisco anytime soon, but it is a pretty interesting shift. And Colin, are there other Asian American organizations in the city that are reflecting this trend to your knowledge?
I mean, certainly you see the moderate leaning Asian American advocates and political leaders increasingly advocating for things like strict action against public safety and visible homelessness and drug crises. And some of that, I think, does speak to the same issues that are behind what we see in the rightward shift among some Asian American voters. And among the Republicans locally in San Francisco, a group called Briones Society that I spent some time reporting with has, you know, a good number of Asian Americans and Chinese Americans who are, you know, joining them, people who used to vote Democratic and now are voting Republican because they said they feel like locally Democrats haven't taken good enough care of the city's public safety situation. Again, it's still a pretty small percentage. San Francisco, you know, still was the county in California that had the lowest share of Trump voters statewide. But I think we should be paying attention to it.
And the Briones Society, I believe, is Republican. Is that correct?
That's right.
And Colin, in your reporting, when did you first start noticing this shift? And what do you think prompted it?
I think that the COVID-19 pandemic certainly was a trigger. The sense of more frustration among Chinese Americans in the city in particular, who are frustrated about public safety situation and feeling like local Democratic leadership has not done enough about it. Again, this is a small group, but that sense of frustration was triggered, I think, by that, as well as the perception of increased anti-Asian hate incidents during that time. Also nationwide, the movement against affirmative action played out here locally as well, with, you know, many Chinese American parents taking umbrage with Lowell High School trying to shift away from merit-based admissions, and that feeling that progressive politics doesn't represent this particular group subset of Asian American voters' interests, I think, started to push more people toward Republican Party registration, even as, you know, we still are also seeing a huge increase in Democratic Asian American voters and, you know, just Asian American voters in general getting more politically engaged. So let's not forget that other side of the aisle as well.
And Jeremy Lee, as president of the Rose Pack Democratic Club here in the city, you mentioned how you're doing a lot of outreach to voters. Can you talk about some of the different attitudes that you've observed just within San Francisco's Chinese American community? I mean, obviously no community is monolithic in how they think, but what are some of the fault lines that you've observed?
Oh, yeah, of course. You know, like you've stated, you know, the Chinese community is not a monolith. We have many different pockets, many different income socioeconomic levels in San Francisco. Our work is kind of geared more towards the outreaching to monolingual residents. So with these group of people, we have noticed that they have a strong distrust in our institutions. They don't feel like they're quite being served by them. When you, like Colin had mentioned, during the COVID-19 pandemic, we saw that many of our Chinese, our Asian American elders were being attacked. And although this isn't a like brand new phenomenon here in San Francisco, it just cemented the idea that they're not being protected by our systems. And so there is that distrust. And really what we want to do is try to rebuild that in any way we can, because, you know, the fact is, There are probably relatives of mine that have voted for Donald Trump, and I want to be able to have conversations with them and to be able to show them that, how their lives can be improved with involvement in the political process.
Well, let's talk about some of the local issues where I think maybe some of these tensions might have come out in terms of the results in Colin Cheung from the San Francisco Chronicle. Let's talk about Proposition K from November's ballot. Just as a reminder to listeners, that was about permanently closing the Great Highway to cars. And we actually did a segment on that issue in the fall, and passions were definitely running high on our program. So can you talk about what Prop K means to the Asian American community, specifically here in San Francisco?
Yeah, absolutely. So the closure of the Great Highway to cars permanently was highly controversial. And there were Asian American supporters for closing the Great Highway, but there also were many who were against it. And especially if you look at the geographical distribution of who voted for and against Prop K, you'll see that, District 4 and District 1, the Sunset and the Richmonds, which have very significant Asian American voter populations, were vehemently opposed to the closure of the Great Highway, which residents say they depend on to get around their neighborhood. That closure would worsen traffic congestion for them, especially, some Chinese American advocates said for multi-generational Asian American families that live on the West Side. And since the closure of the highway was passed by voters last November, some of these residents have started to mobilize a recall campaign of Supervisor Joel Engardio. The jury's still out on whether the recall campaign will gather enough signatures, but it is, a manifestation of some of that frustration among those voters.
Well, and of course, there was also the school board recall from a few years back. Jeremy Lee, the Chinese American community, was very active in that recall and fought for Lowell High School to remain academically selective, merit-based. Was that a factor here?
In terms of the switch,
your Democratic club not affiliating with the Democratic Party in terms of potentially the shift rightward among some Asian American voters in the city?
I wouldn't say the recalls themselves played any kind of role in our decision, but I think it does show that the Asian American electorate is frustrated with how our city is run, and they need an outlet to show and demonstrate that frustration. These recalls were a vehicle for that.
Mm-hmm. And Colin, let's talk about representation in local government right now. San Francisco is 22% ethnically Chinese, but the community is ultimately underrepresented in city leadership right now. And Asian Americans, I know, were better represented in the past. We used to have Mayor Ed Lee, for example. Do you think that's also playing into this dynamic to some extent?
Yeah, absolutely. From 2014 until, even now, there's been a very noticeable decline in Asian American representation on the Board of Supervisors. There used to be 5 out of the 11 supervisors were Asian American. Last year, it was down to 1 with Supervisor Connie Chan. And in a city that is 1/5 Chinese American, that is definitely an underrepresentation. This year, there are 3 supervisors who are Asian American, 2 of whom are Chinese. So I think the community is celebrating that as a win for representation. But at the same time, I think the reason behind this shift that, some advocates and political watchers are noticing is that some voters are moving away from voting just based on identity. And some Asian and Chinese American voters are voting more based on issues and who they feel best represents them. We'll continue to see this play out, I'm sure, in the coming months and years.
Well, Jeremy Lee, just have about a minute or so left. Wanted to end by asking you, do you see the political mood stabilizing in San Francisco now, or do you think that things might continue to shift among the city's Asian American voters?
I think for me, the takeaway in this current political climate is that Asian American voters are up for grabs. They are much more open to candidates from different affiliations. But really, they want someone in terms of political candidates that can understand their needs and can really deliver. Whoever is best suited to do that will gain the Asian American vote.
And to you, Colin, just last thoughts on this. Do you think this is a part of a larger trend or stabilizing here? Just about 30 seconds left.
I think it's part of a larger trend, and I think we'll have to continue to watch it. You know, not to forget the fact that Asian American voters in San Francisco helped to deliver Donald Trump's presidential victory last November, and helped predict which precincts actually went to Trump in San Francisco. So we're going to have to keep watching that as the next 4 years of his presidency plays out.
All right, well, we're going to have to leave it there, but I just want to thank you both so much for joining us. Jeremy Lee of the Rose Pack Democratic Club and Colin Cheung, Asian American and Pacific Islander reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Thank you both. And coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll talk to UCSF scientists and doctors about continuing their work in an uncertain funding environment. That's right after the break, so stay with us.
Join us for Your Legal Rights Wednesday evenings at 6. Host Jeff Hayden and guests cover a wide variety of legal topics and issues, from tax tips to landlord-tenant issues, discrimination and workers' rights on the job, as well as broader constitutional issues. That's Your Legal Rights every Wednesday evening at 6, here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco Bay Area, and online at kalw.org.
Support for KALW comes from Cal Fire, reminding listeners that California fights fire with fire. Prescribed fires help keep California's forests healthier and communities safer. Learn more at preventwildfireca.org.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. In its efforts to reshape the federal government and reduce costs, the Trump administration is making changes to federal agencies supporting our nation's public health. The National Institutes of Health has reduced funding for medical research, and the Centers for Disease Control has taken down health data and patient guidance from its websites. Now, here locally in San Francisco, UCSF depends on federal grants for its cutting-edge research and for its patient care. And in 2023, UCSF received almost $800 million in total funding from the NIH, more than any other public university in the nation. It's an important national center of excellence in scientific research, as well as San Francisco's biggest healthcare provider, and it is also the city's second biggest employer. So what do these changes at the federal level mean for the doctors and scientists here in the Bay Area, as well as for their patients? Well, here to discuss, we're so pleased to be joined by Dr. Peter Chin Hong, an infectious disease doctor at UCSF and frequent contributor to State of the Bay. Welcome back, Peter.
Thanks for having me on, Ethan.
And we're also pleased to be joined by Pamela Munster, professor in the Department of Medicine in Hematology Oncology at UCSF and the director of the Early Phase Clinical Trials Unit at the UCSF Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center, among other appointments and credentials as well. So welcome to State of the Bay, Pamela.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
And we also want you, our listeners, to be part of this next conversation. We're going to be talking about the impact of changes to the federal support for public health and medical research. And so if you or someone you know are in a clinical trial that's being impacted by funding disruptions, or if you support these actions by the federal government to reduce investments in our healthcare system, we'd love to hear from you. You can call and tell us why you have these opinions and what your experiences have been like. You can give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also find us on social media, or you can email us with any questions or comments you might have at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Well, Peter, let me start with you. So university-affiliated hospitals really do rely on federal grants, and they're getting hit really hard right now. Can you just start by explaining why university-affiliated hospitals like UCSF and Stanford, just to the south of us here, are so important?
Yeah, so I think these institutions really rely on federal funding, which is bipartisan, has bipartisan support for a variety of things. People think it's only direct research that's an investigator applying for a particular research study based on an idea, but actually it funds the whole running of the operations, like jobs, like equipment, and I'm sure Dr. Munster will go into it some more, but it affects so many aspects of our lives that it's not an individual impact. It's really the whole community, because so much of us share resources we rely on each person having a variety of things that they do. So if you take away one piece of it, the whole ship will fall down.
And Peter, what is the difference between a public and private hospital, just in terms of funding and their overall impact on people and the medical health field?
Well, private institutions and universities tend to have more endowment. That is, people who donate money and they use it to invest. Public institutions can have endowments as well, but they tend to be a little bit lower in number. So we probably disproportionately rely on state and federal support to keep our ships running.
And Peter, just to stay with you for another question here, what can university-affiliated hospitals do for Bay Area patients specifically that a non-teaching hospital can't do?
Well, I think what we have access to, and I think Dr. Munce's work really exemplifies this, is really that bench-to-bedside aspect where you can take something that you observe in the lab, and once it's proven to be safe, you can rapidly, put it into, or offer it to patients who may not have any other options. We also have networks, apart from specialists in certain areas, where we can use that network to enroll patients into certain kinds of studies and have them have access to medications when nobody else has. I mean, even from my own purview, in the beginning of the COVID pandemic, you know, we were one of the first institutions to get access to remdesivir because of our regulatory heft and our network. And similarly for Mpox, when we had tecovirimat. So I think, you know, all of these things, we never know when something is going to happen. And we rely on all of these mechanisms to get medicines to patients in an expedient way, and medicines that may not be as widely available.
Well, Dr. Pamela Munzer, let me bring you into this. First of all, can you just describe your area of research?
Yeah, thank you again for having me. So what I do is we look at new strategies in the lab, and we test them on cell culture in a really very, very basic research platform. And then when we have a new strategy and we may have a new drug that we think works particularly well in a certain type of cancer, we bring it in the first clinical trials. That often takes, if you will, a village, right? We need to have not just the bench scientists, we need to have core facilities, we need facilities that help us create the drug, manufacture a drug, evaluate the drug. We need to have a regulatory body that determines that what I think is safe is really indeed safe. These are called institutional review boards. They're often supported by independent funding. But then another really very crucial part that may be different than if we have pharmaceutically sponsored drug is we have an opportunity to now observe patients and how they do and how they benefit from a drug or not benefit, and then take it back to the bench. So the common bench to bedside, just as an important part, is the bedside to back to bench. So I think this research endeavor and support, particularly when it comes to cancers that are more rare, pediatric cancers, tumors that are not as frequently seen as breast and colon cancer, research on such cancer be very, very difficult to do on a commercial pharmaceutical sponsored platform.
And Pamela, for listeners who don't know just how this all works in terms of budgets and funding, what are the main sources of federal funding for medical research like yours?
So we of course, often our research is supported by NCI grants, R1 grants, smaller grants. Junior faculties have smaller grants and more senior faculties. What we do is we put the 5-year strategy plan together and then submit it to the National Cancer Institute, because I do cancer, my grants go to the National Cancer Institute. Then there is a review committee that typically is comprised about 20 to 30 peers, if you will. These are independent researchers not involved in my research directly. They cannot be my friends or colleagues because they would be conflicted and excluded. They then review my work for merit, and then if it's it is of merit, and what typically a grant does not get funded unless it's in the 10th percentile. So out of all the grants, say you have 100 grants that get reviewed in this, what we call the study section, only about 10% get funded. So as is, there's a very rigorous review process, and there's a pretty high selection. So it is really not like anything goes, and the government funds pretty much any idea. There's a very thorough review on should the project be funded.
And I know in the last few days, the NIH announced it's going to put a 15% limit on grants that cover administrative overhead so as to use the funding on the research itself. And today it was announced that 22 state attorneys general, including California's, are suing the Trump administration regarding putting this lower cap on funding for administrative costs, or I guess you could say higher cap. It's moving it down to 15% from a higher percent limit that many universities have in place. Can you explain what these additional funds for overhead pay for? It sounds very kind of technical, maybe arcane, but what's the real world impact here?
Yeah, so when I get money to do research, what that direct cost really pays is the actual experiments, the people who execute on the experiments, and materials, supplies, and things. What it doesn't actually pay for is the lab building, the lab benches, the large confocal microscopy groups. Is that there's a lot of what we do is really, really high tech, and we do this on fairly expensive machines. And of course, it would not be worthwhile for me as an individual to buy such a machine. The grants don't actually pay for equipment. So my direct money does not pay for any equipment. So indirect help offset equipment, and equipment is typically shared among the many researchers of us.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, this is State of the Bay on local public radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're discussing the risks caused by cuts to federal funding from cuts to medical research and healthcare more generally. We're speaking with Peter Chin Hong, an infectious disease doctor at UCSF and frequent contributor to State of the Bay. And we're also joined by Pamela Munster, professor in the Department of Medicine in Hematology Oncology at UCSF and the director of the Early Phase Clinical Trials Unit at the UCSF Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center. And we want to hear from you as well. Are you a provider who can share your experience or concerns around funding cuts? Are you currently seeking treatment that might be interrupted because of these cuts? You can call us and join the conversation by dialing 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. We do have a comment from Rick in Citrus Heights who writes, as a patient at the University of California, San Francisco, myself, I will tell you that I would be devastated if we eliminated funding, not only for public health, but also for research that I feel I would benefit from, as I'm a patient in the Department of Neurological Surgery and in the Department of Ophthalmology. And a shout out to my doctors there. Thank you, Rick, for that. Dr. Peter Chin Hong, are you hearing this kind of sentiment from your patients? What are the patients saying in response to all this uncertainty now at the federal level in terms of funding?
I think everyone is worried because we do rely very heavily on federal funding, even though, you know, if there's any place to be, I'd really happy to be in the Bay Area during this time like COVID. People are worried. And, you know, I think science has a risk of being slowed down, and particularly in a dynamic infectious disease time, speaking from my pulpit, it couldn't have come in a worse time.
And obviously, Pamela is very impacted by volatility and cuts at the NIH. But Peter, with your area, infectious diseases, as you just mentioned, it's also impacted. Can you talk about what's happening right now at the Centers for Disease Control or CDC and how that's impacting your work?
Yeah, so there are two big things happening at the CDC and other related agencies. One is the pause in communication that started off January 21st. And of course, some of the communications were resumed, but just a fraction of all the web pages we rely on for patient education, for up-to-date information. And the second impact that we had from the CDC was really related to the pause in communications is the actual active removal of patient information, physician information websites on certain disease topics. So I think both those two things, particularly around the idea of not feeling confident that we will get information as fast as we need it, kind of leaves me and, you know, my patients probably in a bind right now, even though we live in California.
Well, Peter, first of all, do you have any sense as to why they're taking that information down? And then I guess as a quick follow-up here, what are some of the examples of disease topics that, you know, you might be tracking? Just thinking of, for example, avian bird flu. I mean, that's so much in the news now, leading to the price of eggs going up, you know, nationwide, one of the sort of reasons cited for Trump getting elected in the first place. But yeah, what is the motivation and what kind of diseases are you tracking that now is harder to access?
So I think the motivation is at its essence very similar to every time a new administration comes, which is that you temporarily pause communication so that you can align everyone to make sure everyone's on the same page. But I think the length of time and the scope of what's involved is somewhat unprecedented. And in terms of motivation, apart from alignment, you know, looking at some of the websites that were removed from the CDC, for example, a lot of them that deals with gender identity have been removed regardless of the topic. For example, you could be looking at, infectious disease that's, like chlamydia or reproductive medicine. Anytime you talk about something that has, you know, predilection to one gender or another, it's been altered. So I think for those two reasons, and specific examples in my work are related to influenza, like you mentioned. We're in the middle of the biggest influenza outbreak in this country or surge for 15 years. We already have 20 million cases and we're still on the way up in California. So a specific example of the impact on my work is I can't really look at active dashboards anymore. It's kind of like a little bit old because of the review process. Another example is, like you mentioned, bird flu. You know, we recently had news that there was a new strain in Nevada of the type that caused a patient in Louisiana to die. It's called D1.1. And just today we heard that there was a patient who might have it, who was a dairy worker. So I think that, having access to that information about the impact on cats and how cats can get infected from humans, humans could potentially get infected from cats. All of that is not just information trivia, it's information that really shapes how I talk to patients and how I counsel people about risk in this very dynamic time.
We have an email in from a listener, Sam, who writes, really interesting conversation so far. I'm wondering if labs at UCSF will have increased access to funding coming from private donors to supplement, or I suppose perhaps replace, the federal NIH, NSF funding cuts. Pamela, what do you think of that prospect and Sam's comment here? Is there a way we could backfill some of this funding if it, I mean, we know the overhead costs are proposed to be cut permanently, but if some of these other funding programs that were in the pipeline are ultimately successful and being gutted?
Yeah, I think we have always been lucky that the Bay Area has many, many very generous residents who have been helping us supplement funding and NIH. And as I mentioned before, like NIH funding is extremely competitive. Like if you submit a grant and it's only one in 10 chance of getting funded, you apply for lots of grants in your life as a researcher. So I think we take all the support we can, and that is something we frequently do, but the National Cancer Institute funding is really important for us.
I think a
very crucial part of it is also not just whether we get funding or not, but it's the uncertainty on whether this is actually happening. As like, I have to tell patients they can't go on a clinical trial. I can't do anything for their cancer right now because I don't know whether the clinical trial is going to happen or not. It's quite devastating. So I think it's, and I think that perhaps to tell someone I can't answer when is really challenging.
Mm-hmm. And Pamela, is this going to potentially lead to job cuts, do you think?
I'm worried about the job cuts, but even more so, I'm truly worried that we don't have young, dedicated scientists what we are, the clinician scientists, those who do bench research and do science work, that those folks will not pursue a career like this. It's like it's just such an important part that we take observation from the bedside, finding out what doesn't work in patients, bring it back to the research lab and study it so we don't expose more patients to things that may not be active. So that mm-hmm. that interplay between science and clinical work is so important. But if we can't attract the best and the brightest to do this work because there's no funding, that makes it very, very challenging for us to really stay at the level that we have always been, like being really in the forefront of innovation.
And Pamela, what do you say to people who might respond, well, this is a capitalist country, we should be letting drug companies do the research into new treatments and taxpayer dollars really shouldn't be funding this? What would your response be?
I think cancer drug development is a very strong interplay of many stakeholders. I think pharmaceutically sponsored drug development is hugely is hugely important, and it's probably where a large bulk of new drugs come from. But their obligations is somewhat different to the larger groups of people. So I think if we only have drug companies sponsoring research, we'll have great drugs for the big cancers like breast, colon, lung, maybe prostate. But people with rare diseases will not have good drugs. There will be not as much drug in childhood diseases. And I really worry about what happens to cancer care for children.
Yeah, and the long-term effects could really be significant. Well, Peter, our listeners probably remember you if they were listening at all during the COVID-19 era. We were talking to you regularly for updates during the pandemic. And after that, there was a push to get the CDC to focus on providing better disease detection, better testing, more data collection, better treatments. But I want to talk to you about disease detection. Did we ramp that up at all after the pandemic? Because that feels like it's a basic public health responsibility. Is that still happening?
It's happening in spurts. I would say that, you know, there's no big driver anymore. There's no sense of a conductor of the orchestra. And again, California is doing what it can, but infectious diseases knows no borders, like in COVID. We need to rely on the federal orchestration. We really need to rely on the world, like the World Health Organization. And since you're talking about surveillance, we rely on that global community to tell us what's going on somewhere else because it will generally impact us at some point.
Well, and you mentioned the World Health Organization. Of course, Trump has had the U.S. leave the WHO. Why should someone who lives in the Bay Area care about being a part of the World Health Organization? What does that bring to the average person?
So I think, it's been pitched as the fact that we put a lot of money in, which is true. We are one of the biggest contributors to the WHO financially, but it goes both ways. In return, I think we get access to specimens. That's how we got the molecular, structure of SARS-CoV-2 to make the mRNA vaccine. It's through global cooperation and how we know about variants. I think we rely on them even when you think about influenza, because we look at those isolates in other parts of the world when they're having their winter in order to determine what vaccines we should put together for our winter several months later. So, you know, I think we will not have as much access to all these specimens in a timely way or sequences. We won't necessarily know what's going on in other parts of the world. For example, today I had a patient, I'm on service now, who had recently traveled to West Africa and is at risk for certain types of diseases like Ebola and other like diseases. I couldn't really rely on my usual sources to know if there was a current outbreak there, for example, in order to determine whether or not my risk is higher or not. So that's another example of how it affects somebody individually, in addition to the public health and population level impact that I'd mentioned.
And Peter, in terms of filling this void here, can local or state health departments help pick up some of the slack?
Yes, definitely we can. And they have not stopped working. California is still on overdrive. This is where the epicenter of bird flu is right now, because we have so much agriculture. So they've been working hard, but we really, really rely on the CDC and other federal entities for resources, for communication, again, to keep up on a dashboard. That's only so good in just looking at one state. So, you know, I think it's a big loss right now.
And we have an email in from Jack who writes, it seems like medical research is something that the U.S. is a leader on. What is the reason for crippling the system that we are good at? Pamela, you've been speaking to that to some extent. Do you want to respond to Jack?
Yeah, I think this is an excellent point. I can only echo this. We are among the leaders of innovation and new development, and crippling this is really somewhat short-sighted.
Yeah. And Pamela, what are you doing to gird yourself against these disruptions and likely future disruptions? Even if these cuts get tied up in court, they're still going to be impacting your day-to-day work. So how are you preparing now?
We are, of course, doubling down our efforts, trying to have other sources of funding. Philanthropy was mentioned. And rallying around, I think we are not quite clear at how much the cuts were going to be. I think we, of course, all remain optimistic that there'll be reversals and they're going to be a reinitiation of some of these funding. But I think what I most struggle is the uncertainty of where we're going to land.
And Peter, any advice for listeners out there who might be worried that their care will be disrupted or harder to access, or if they want to support UCSF philanthropically or otherwise?
Well, I think that, you know, we've always relied on our community. And even during COVID most recently, you know, the Bay Area and philanthropy and biotech stepped in when we didn't have diagnostic tests because they use smart thermometers. We are always innovative. We are always sharing. So I think, you know, just continue to remember that, you know, who your trusted sources are. And I know that we will continue to prioritize patient care and work together as much as we can.
Well, we greatly appreciate the work that you do and also coming on to our program to explain it to us. I'll thank you both individually. Dr. Peter Chin-Hong, infectious disease doctor at UCSF, thank you so much for coming back on the program.
Thanks so much, Ethan.
And Dr. Pamela Munster, professor in the Department of Medicine and Hematology Oncology at UCSF, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for letting us share our thoughts.
And wishing you the best of luck with your work, and especially given these turbulent federal funding and otherwise times. Coming up after the break, we're going to talk to the director of a new documentary about how the human-dog bond can be used to rehabilitate incarcerated people. If you're a dog lover, you're not going to want to miss this one, so stay with us.
Join us for Your Legal Rights Wednesday evenings at 6. Host Jeff Hayden and guests cover a wide variety of legal topics and issues, from tax tips to landlord-tenant issues, discrimination and workers' rights on the job, as well as broader constitutional issues. That's Your Legal Rights every Wednesday evening at 6, here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco Bay Area, and online at KALW.org.
Hey, this is One Way Possible, your sonic scavenger. It's Monday, and tonight I will be with you from 8 to 10 p.m. So join me and catch a vibe right here on KALW 91.7 FM and KALW.org.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Tonight, we have a story about prisoners and rescue dogs, men serving time and dogs running out of it. But put them together and something unexpected happens. That's the story filmmaker Ashia Soleil tells us about in her new documentary, Underdogs. Ashia Soleil, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thanks. Wonderful to be here.
Your film follows four inmates in the San Mateo County Jail in Redwood City as they participated in a program where they were each given an under-socialized rescue dog that they train and care for 24/7 over 8 weeks. Well, tell us a little bit about the program itself. What's it called and who sponsors it?
So the program is called the TAILS Program, which is an acronym for Transitioning Animals into Loving Situations. It's a partnership with the Peninsula Humane Society and the San Mateo Sheriff's Office. And the purpose of the program is to create a win-win situation where inmates who have a lot of time on their hands are able to take under-socialized animals and use positive reinforcement to give the dogs certain skills. The dogs become adoptable. And in fact, the program was very successful. I think it had nearly 100 dogs that had gone through the program, and virtually all of them got adopted.
Oh, well, this is really good for the dogs, but it's actually really good for the people. And in your film, these men who are incarcerated, and I should say this is a minimum security situation, and these are men who have experienced hard times, and they really open up to you to tell their stories. I'd like to play a clip of one of the incarcerated individuals. His name is Mac, about his experience training his very sweet dog, Spice.
This is the most normal that I've felt in the last 9 years. She brings me joy. I mean, I can't see her without smiling and being happy, and I get down on the floor and play with her, you know what I mean? And you know, you just, I'm not used to acting that way in jail or prison, you know. But then I'm a big guy, so I can look at the other guys and go, shut up, you know. Don't even look at me funny. That's my dog, you know. You know, they say America is a place for second acts, second chances. And I believe that.
If this changes me in any way, it makes me more a softer kind of person and not such a hard ass. Yeah, I'm not the most lovable person in the world, you know what I mean? I got some rough edges around me.
How did you build up enough trust with people like Mac and other men in the program to get them to open up like this?
Well, I attribute it in part to being an educational psychologist and school psychologist. I have to meet a wide variety of people and be able to talk with them. I also have lived overseas quite a bit and believe that in general, when you treat people with respect, they will be open to you.
Were you surprised by the transformations you witnessed over the 8 weeks of this program?
Yes. And I think it was because the communication between animals that are not judgmental and humans really made a big difference. Some of these people, I don't believe, had had connections, strong connections in their lives. So the ability to be able to communicate with an animal and train them really made a big difference.
You know, they talk a lot about in the film about getting that unconditional love from this animal. And as you said, no judgment.
Right. And the original program was started by a woman who called herself a rogue nun. She had actually grown up in a different faith and been on the streets at one point. And she credited a dog with having saved her life. And so what she wanted to do was, when she became a nun, she wanted to put the love of dog into the prison system. And she started a program, which is still in existence up in Washington State, and worked with medium to maximum security women who trained the dogs to become helper dogs for the handicapped. And so these are very highly specialized dogs, and it takes real skill to turn these dogs around and for the women to be training them. As a result, some of the women who had been in the prison system for 10, 15 years would get a job within a month. Mm-hmm. And more surprisingly, the national recidivism rate, or rate of going back into prisons, is about 66%. In this particular program, it was 0 to 5%, which is just
a... Wow. I mean, that goes back to like, who's really helping who here, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Was there a specific moment during filming or an aspect of the story that left a lasting impact on you?
There were quite a few, but in general, I think hearing Mac talk at the end of the film about the changes that he had made, I so appreciated the vulnerability of all the subjects and just that they opened up for them to be able to make that connection, help another being change, was really transformative.
Mm. Well, Mac talks about how he was disciplined with a belt growing up. And I mean, he contrasts that with how they train the dogs with positive reinforcement, with no violence. And he says he wishes there was more positive reinforcement in the criminal justice system. I mean, this program itself feels like a positive reinforcement, but having witnessed this, are there more things that you think that the carceral system can do to help rehabilitate its inhabitants?
Absolutely. First of all, I'd say that having positive reinforcement be a great start. Mm-hmm. I also think that it's wonderful for there to be interaction between society and the incarcerated, because often these people are faceless. We don't know about them. And win-win situations should be celebrated and widespread, right?
Watching the movie, I was really struck by the inmates saying they so valued the program. They were so grateful for this job. You know, in the outside world, maybe they didn't appreciate their work, but this is a job that they really valued. They didn't want to do anything to screw it up. They didn't want to get into trouble. They didn't want to have the privilege taken away from them. I mean, that kind of just shows how important this particular program was to the people participating in it.
Absolutely.
And I think another unsung heroine of this program is the trainer. I think her name was Martina, who worked with both the dogs. And she helped the men understand how to train a dog, which is not necessarily something that comes naturally. They're not just spending time with dogs. They're also helping to train these dogs.
Absolutely. She was training the trainers. And she's German, and she was a wonderful character, right? She's very humorous, and I think she had just the right touch. She was able to instruct the inmates well.
Is this program still in existence?
It was stopped during COVID, and so it's on hiatus. I would love to see it come back to life, and I'm going to be inviting hopefully some people from the program to come to the event on the 13th.
Oh, and we should mention, so there's going to be a special screening of the film Underdogs this Thursday, February 13th at 6 p.m. at the Delancey Street Screening Room in San Francisco. And people can find a link to it on the State of the Bay website if they want to get tickets. Underdogs has also been picked up by PBS, hasn't it?
It has. It's been played on over 80% of all the PBS stations across the country. If people do want to see the film, they can go to my website, which is underdogsdocumentary.com, and they can see that film as well as a few other shorts that I have.
Well, it's definitely worth the time. And Ashia Soleil, I want to thank you so much for joining us on State of the Bay.
Thank you so much, Grace. It's been wonderful to be here.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. And you just heard my co-host Grace Wan with that interview. We'll be off next Monday for President's Day, but we hope you'll join us the following Monday at 6 when we'll talk to the author of the new book, Boy Mom, among other things. And remember to subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast wherever you listen and never miss an episode. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page on KALW.org. And if you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, just let us know. You can email us anytime. We're at stateofthebay@KALW.org. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb and Ann Harper. It was engineered by David Kwan, and D Minor was our board operator. So coming up, tuning into an episode of Your Call, I actually hosted this morning. So listen to that. And I'm Ethan Elkind. Good night, and thanks for listening.